Welcome to the podcast service of Sydney's FM 103.2, available on the web at fm1032.com.au.
Professor Geoffrey Sachs is to countries what doctors are to people. His extensive career has seen him advise more than 100 countries on how to reduce poverty. He's advised former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and has even given economics lessons to U2 rocker Bono. For the last 3 years, Geoffrey Sachs has directed the United Nations Millennium Project, a plan to see global poverty and hunger halved by 2015. In his book, The End of Poverty, Professor Sachs surmises that extreme poverty could be brought to an end as soon as 2025. And he joins us now. Geoffrey Sachs, welcome to Open House.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Certainly an ambitious plan, 2025. What needs to happen in order for poverty to come to an end by that time?
The good news is that a lot of poverty is being ended by the wonders of modern technology and the good side of globalization. You have all through Asia, of course, very rapid economic growth, and poverty rates and absolute numbers living in extreme poverty in China, now India, people throughout Southeast Asia going down in significant numbers. The problem is that there are pockets of poverty, more than pockets, regions of the world where extreme poverty has so far proved resistant to the forces of globalization, where market forces are bypassing people and where the suffering is extreme. To put it in a nutshell, the key is to get those parts of the world also connected to the positive drive of the world economy and the positive momentum of technology. If Africa, Central Asia, parts of South America, especially the Andean region, can get connected to global trade and investment the same way as the dynamic parts of Asia, well, we'll see the end of poverty. The problem is, and the point of my book is that that won't happen automatically. It won't happen just by itself. We have to help make it happen.
Because you have to ask that when you've got a regime like, say, Robert Mugabe's in Zimbabwe, when there is a corrupt regime in place, can any of those things ever happen?
Well, of course, governments are able to destroy the chances, and we have, unfortunately, enough thugs around. But the issue goes well beyond the problems of governance, and this, I think, is what people need to understand. It's not just the cases of a regime like Mr. Mugabe's or like North Korea's. There are well-governed places that are impoverished for other reasons. Maybe malaria and AIDS are holding these places back. Maybe it's the lack of basic infrastructure such as roads and electricity, the lack of access to safe drinking water, or what is often the case, very fragile agriculture, where places experience significant droughts. Now, Australia had one itself, but places that are vulnerable every 2 or 3 years to extreme drought and with much lower productivity and smaller land per person than you have in a wealthy country like Australia. So that problem of agriculture, the problem of disease, the problem of lack of infrastructure needs special attention. And I think the key for us is to realize that a cliche that we have in our minds often, that the poor are just the victims of their own government, is too simple. The poor can also be victims of climate, disease, lack of infrastructure, and so on. And those are solvable problems, and we can help them solve those problems.
Right. So your idea is let's focus on those kinds of combatible issues and wait for the other regimes to change?
Absolutely. Yeah. And as you made the analogy to a medical doctor, and I like that analogy. In my book, I talk about clinical economics. I've watched my wife, a wonderful clinician, a pediatrician, do her work over the last 25 years, and it's always impressed me how in order to treat a child, you have to know, of course, the details of the specific ailment. You have to know the conditions of the family life. You have to be able to interpret things very carefully, and so you realize that a fever isn't just a fever. It has to be understood at its root causes. Similarly with extreme poverty, we need to get away from the simple idea, simplistic idea, that extreme poverty is simply the fault of one thing. We need to do a kind of differential diagnosis, understand what are the sources of the problems, work with those problems that are solvable. In most cases, in my experience, in most parts of the world, extreme poverty could be brought down significantly by the application of proven, straightforward investments in the right places if the diagnosis is made properly.
Well, Professor Jeffrey Sachs is our guest on Open House tonight. Let's talk more about that, Jeffrey. What kind of investments are you talking about? When, where, how?
Let me take the case of the Millennium Villages where we're working in sub-Saharan Africa. We're working in 12 regions in sub-Saharan Africa that are among the very poorest spots in the whole world. And in all of these cases, the people are suffering from a profound lack of basic productivity. They don't grow enough food even to stay alive reliably, much less to earn a surplus that they can bring to the market and start climbing out of poverty. When you do a diagnosis of what's happening in these villages, though they differ according to the specific geography and ecology, you find out that the targets for investment are to raise productivity of the farming, to help people have access to basic health care so they're healthy. That's a direct input to well-being, but it also raises productivity. To ensure that there's a school for their children and a school feeding program so that the children have nourishment enough to learn and to be able to be in school. And basic infrastructure. There needs to be a road. There needs to be some connection to electricity to manage pumps or a refrigerator in a clinic or to recharge a telephone, which might be the single lifeline of connection for a whole village to the rest of the nation or to the world. So basic interventions, and I classify them as in agriculture, in public health, in education, and in infrastructure, meaning roads, power, water, and sanitation. Now, when you look at the costs of those interventions, they turn out to be remarkably small compared to the benefits. Perhaps $50 per person per year in these villages brought in from the outside when combined with resources in the villages and at the national level and from other partner organizations is enough to spell the difference between death from neglect and extreme poverty, and not only life, but life with economic improvement leading to self-sustaining economic development. Mm. It's amazing how little can go an enormous way to save lives, help children to grow up healthy, and give impoverished communities a chance to move forward.
Yeah. And so when it comes to the financial aspects of this, are you thinking that this needs to be funded by more foreign aid from I guess, more wealthy Western countries?
We are so rich in the world right now in our own countries that it would take significantly less than just 1% of our income to be able to get the bed nets and the fertilizers and the medicines and the treadle pumps, the roads paved, the clinics built, that would spell the difference not only between life and death, but also between economic development and continued extreme poverty. So it would not take the rich world much. If this were done on a voluntary basis, wonderful. But the fact of the matter is it's not being done on a voluntary basis. And that means that it really is the collective effort of government that has to pick up the responsibility. And our governments, to be honest about it, have recognized this all along. They've promised time and again to give 0.7% of gross national product as official aid. Australia's made the promise. The United States has made the promise. Indeed, all of the high-income countries have made the promise. But only five of them have lived up to the promise, and not Australia, not the United States, but rather some Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Netherlands, and Luxembourg. Well, that's not a great record for the more than 20 donor countries. The several other European countries are now on record and on track to reach 0.7%. So the whole European Union has promised that the core members will give 0.7 of national income as official aid by 2015. Unfortunately, Australia has not made that promise. The United States has not made that promise. Canada hasn't made that promise. And I think that's a real, unfortunately, a real shortcoming of our societies. We promised, but we're not delivering.
What about getting the money actually to the countries and actually down to the field and how we can do that effectively? I was in Indonesia earlier this year and talking to folks that had been affected by the earthquake there in May last year. And the fact is that aid was given, but it was very, very hard for it to get right to the people who needed it. It seemed to go through government agency after government agency, and it was more siphoned off and more siphoned off. How do we actually get the money to the people who need it?
Well, the key is to have a program approach that works right in the communities themselves, and that's what the Millennium Villages do, for example. And people can learn more about this at millenniumpromise.org. With aid, we shouldn't just give a transfer of money. We should be helping with specific needs. Again, agriculture, the health sector, education of children, basic infrastructure are the things that the poorest countries need. And beyond that, they really have to have their own leadership and responsibility to develop the private sector and to undertake economic growth. What concerns me and what I'd like people to understand is that when you have nothing, you can't get started on your own. You need a helping hand. And that is what foreign aid should be all about. It's not a guarantee. It's not a transfer. It's not simply redistribution of income. It's helping to empower the poor so that they can escape from the trap of poverty and get on a path of economic development. The more practical the approach is, and the more holistic the approach is, in other words, targeting several key sectors simultaneously in a mutually reinforcing way, the faster and more reliably this is going to happen.
So we can encourage our governments to stay to their promises and even up their promises when it comes to foreign aid. What about individuals? What can individuals do when it comes to the grand plan of reducing poverty by 2025?
I think individuals should, first of all, learn about these commitments, learn about the global goals like the Millennium Development Goals, learn about how straightforward it is, in fact, to make a major difference, and then support programs, whether it's like Millennium Villages or donations of anti-malaria bed nets or other efforts of UNICEF or the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria. Support those programs within the means of individuals. If we all did give, even out of our own generosity, 0.7 of 1% of our incomes, well, that would do the job. So the more private contributions well-targeted there are, the less our government has to finish closing the gap. Unfortunately, the government isn't doing its side of the bargain at all. It isn't even following through on the promises that have been made.
This is Open House, and Jeffrey Sachs, economist and director of the United Nations Millennium Project, is our guest. I'm interested, what do you think about the role of churches in the fight against poverty and what role they can actually play when it comes to the goal of 2025?
Well, of course, the churches have two enormous roles to play. They have, out of the tenets of religion, a major commitment to helping the poor. And so there are major church movements that collect resources and donate for the poor. The churches also play a delivery or service delivery mechanism. You go to almost any impoverished rural area in Africa, there's a church there. And that church may be helpful in distributing anti-malaria bed nets, or it may be helpful in helping with the water or running the local clinic. Many church denominations are playing an important role in this, and it does go on both ends. The churches, in most cases, are international organizations, and therefore they reach us in our own communities, and they reach the poorest of the poor in their communities.
You've talked about how In many ways, ending poverty is the great opportunity of our time. Why do you think that we are the generation, more than any other generation, that can see the end of poverty, extreme poverty?
It's the arithmetic, you know. The wealth that we have and the power of technology to have already reduced poverty in so many places in the world means that for the first time in history, we have the tools among the high-income countries and among the technologies. And there's enough literacy and connectivity in the poor countries that a modest effort by the rich countries mobilizing these proven technologies could end extreme poverty in the poorest countries. That's the first time this can be said because, go back 30, 40 years, China was so poor and so numerous and so were so many other parts of the world that are now getting out of extreme poverty that the burden that would have been implied for the rich countries with much less powerful tools than we have now would have been much greater than could have been mustered. So now the balance has come the right way. There's enough wealth, there's enough capable technology that if we just make a modest effort in the rich world, we'll have a decisive effect on for the benefit of the poor. We've just got to stop turning our backs to this issue and face it straight on. And we have to tell our own governments, whether it's Prime Minister Howard or whether it's President Bush or others, that the only way this world is going to be safe is not through this military approach, but by investing in peace and investing in development.
Jeffrey Sachs, I am interested because I'm sure that you could be earning a lot more than what you're making now. You've got a role with Columbia University and the United Nations and all sorts of things, but I'm sure that you could be earning big bucks when it comes to boards all around the world. Why are you doing what you're doing? Why do you feel this role is yours to take up and run with?
Can you imagine anything more compelling in life than to see the opportunity to be helpful? I can't actually imagine it. It is true that being a financial market expert, a monetary expert, and so on, there are definitely alternative opportunities. But I find this opportunity to really help solve problems of extreme poverty simply the most meaningful way to live a life that I could imagine. And I know that that's true of a lot of other people. I have wonderful colleagues from the business community who were making huge amounts of money and decided that what they really wanted to do with their lives was devoted to using their great business skills to help solve problems like this. And so we know that because we do have more than we need in the rich world, we have this opportunity to give something, and it is an extremely exhilarating feeling to see that it is possible not only to give but actually to help real progress that way.
Mm. And was there a moment of epiphany for you when you had that kind of change in direction?
Well, for me, I went into economics because I was hoping, I didn't really know, but I was hoping that this profession would give tools, if my eyes were open, that would be useful for the world. So I kind of did go into the field with some hope that it could be really not just a theoretical field, but something useful for the world. Then I started, after a few years of being a professor at Harvard University, with some practical policy advising in South America after having been invited to Bolivia, which was in very deep crisis. And lo and behold, I saw that the things that I had learned were actually helpful. They could really help to solve a very critical problem. I got hooked that way, and I worked on many, many dozens of countries around the world on looking at problems of inflation or instability or currency crises or trade reform. Then I began working in Africa about a dozen years ago, and there the nature of the problems were so severe and the crisis of disease was so great that it did open up a new chapter for me, in essence, of a lot of focus on extreme poverty. the poorest places in Africa are really unlike any other part of the world.
All right. Well, a lot of people can follow in your lead. Thanks for joining us on Open House tonight. It really has been fascinating talking to you. Really appreciate your time.
It's a delight to be with you. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, that's Professor Jeffrey Sachs, the economist and director of the United Nations Millennium Project. And that website that he gave during our chat there, millenniumpromise.org, might be worth a check out. millenniumpromise.org.
We hope you enjoyed this FM 103.2 podcast. To listen to more great audio, visit fm1032.com.au.